It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Mark Bittman has taught millions of people how to cook everything. He is a journalist, food writer, a regular columnist for the New York Times, and author of many best-selling cookbooks, including How to Cook Everything, How to Cook Everything Vegetarian, and most recently, How to Cook Everything Fast. He was going to be giving a free lecture this evening in Iowa City as part of the Food for Thought themed semester at the University of Iowa. That has been canceled because of the blizzard, although the committee is working on rescheduling it. We did get a chance to talk with him last week. Hello, Mark.
How are you doing? Great to be here.
Great. Thank you so much for being here today. And I want to start with a recent opinion column that you wrote in conjunction with the president's State of the Union address. You used your column in the New York Times to address the state of food in this country. And you didn't paint a very pretty picture. You started out with the fact that there's so much need in this country, 46.5 million Americans receiving SNAP benefits. Why do you think that's so important to think about?
I think the answer is pretty clear. If it weren't for SNAP benefits, that means that 46.5 million people would be getting even less to eat than they are now. So supporting SNAP is, I mean, 46, that's a sixth of our population. That is a lot of people. We all know someone who's on food stamps, whether we think we do or not. And they're critically important to many people's, you know, to maintaining nutrition for many, many people.
A lot of people argue that that's not so much a part of the state of food in this country, but a part of the state of the economy in this country. Why do we need to think about it in terms of our food system?
Well, actually, I think I'm one of the people who would argue that it's not a food question. It's a justice question and an income question. But of course, people do need to eat, and it's a, so you can look at it either way you want. It's certainly not a cooking question. It's not a luxury question. It's not a hedonistic question. It's a question of people having their needs met. And I think that, I want to say one thing about that column, because I made a prediction in the column, and the prediction was that the president wouldn't mention anything about food and agriculture, and he didn't. And the administration, for all the good that it's done, has not really addressed food and agriculture in the way that it might. And one statement that could be made by the administration or by a future administration might be something along the lines of every American has the right to fair, affordable, nutritious food. And we don't say that. This country does not assert that people have the right to eat. And I think that that's a very basic and fundamental right that should override many, many other things, I think. So is that a food question, or is that a justice question, or a constitutional question, whatever you want to call it? It's an important thing to address.
It's clear that in a lot of your writing, you consider food issues in this country to have a lot to do with social justice.
True, and I'm quite lucky that I'm able to say that. I do feel that way. Even cooking is an important, you know, I've written about cooking for 35 years. So cooking is an extremely important aspect of nutrition, of food, of the environment, and so on. But there are overriding issues that go way beyond cooking, and I'm lucky to have been able to make the transition into having a column that allows me to address the bigger issues.
Now, while you made a prediction in that column that we wouldn't hear about food in the State of the Union address, you also went on to talk about changes that you feel need to be made to our food supply in this country. And you proposed some very big changes. For example, getting antibiotics out of the food supply was one of the changes that you proposed making. And also tying reducing greenhouse gas emissions to reining in industrial production of animals. When we look at food, when we look at the economy, there are a lot of people in this country who are engaged in industrial level agriculture in this country. Do you really feel that we could take steps of that nature and not put a lot of people at risk for going hungry?
I wouldn't suggest anything that would make people go hungry. Antibiotics have been taken out of the food supply in a couple of European countries. Production is not down but up, and salmonella poisonings are down. So there's benefits in taking antibiotics out of the food supply. I could sit here and say we need to rein in industrial animal production. We need to, eliminate the ethanol mandate. We need to get rid of junk food marketing to children. We need to reduce the amount of nitrates and other nutrients being spilled into the water supply, on and on and on. I think what's important, and all of those things add up to, we need to have a food supply that's sustainable and produces affordable, nutritious food without damaging the environment. I think what we have to do is look at one thing at a time. No one is going to become food czar. No one is going to fix all of this. No one is going to put millions of farmers back to work or out of work. What's important is that we look at the issues that are possible to address, and we try to address those. Antibiotics, I believe, is number one, not because it's the most important thing, but because it's the most addressable thing. The FDA could do something. The Food and Drug Administration could do something about using antibiotics in industrial production of animals. It really has not. So this is a possible thing. This is a doable thing. This is a thing that's been done elsewhere with success. It's demonstrably an okay thing to do, a desirable thing to do. That makes it sort of number one on my list of things we ought to be thinking about.
When you look around at other nations, you mentioned other countries making the decision to take antibiotics out of their food supply. Do you see a model that we could follow? Is there a nation that you see that has a sustainable food supply model that is not damaging the environment, that is providing enough food for the citizens to eat, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, absolutely not. There is no model, but there are many models. And there are good things about what's done agriculturally in the United States that other countries could learn from, but there are traditional methods of farming that produce far more food and feed far more people around the world that we could stand to learn something from too. There's no one who's mastered this. This is a work in progress. And until 10 or 20 years ago, everybody bought the industry line on everything, which was produce more, produce more, produce more. But that has led to malnutrition of two sorts. That is, there's both hunger and obesity in the world, and those are both forms of malnutrition. It's led to agriculture being among the highest contributors to greenhouse gases. It's led to pollution of land, air, and water, and so on. And those things all need to be addressed.
When you look at government policies over the past decades that subsidized industrial agriculture, a lot of government policies went into bringing us to the place where we are today. Do you think that government policy is where we need to focus to try to change the system that we have today?
Such a great question. And I guess there are two answers, or the answer has two parts. One is yes. I mean, we invented industrial agriculture in its current form. We can uninvent it. And one policy at a time, one intelligent agency decision at a time, we will. But I think individuals have a role to play also. So just to finish on this first thought, obviously, I would say that we need better representatives in Congress. We need stronger people in agencies. We need less of a revolving door policy between lobbyists and government agencies and so on. That would help. But on an individual level, there are things we can do to change things. And even something as simple as changing our diet has an impact on what's grown and what's going to be grown. It has an impact certainly on our personal health and therefore on our national health, and it even has a little impact on climate change and other aspects of the environment. So the decisions we make as individuals are important ones. It's just important to be aware that not everybody is capable of making the same decisions. Not everybody's capable of making the same changes in their lives. Change is difficult. Marketing encourages us to act against our best interests in many cases. So it's fine to talk about individual choice and individual responsibility. I believe we all, to a greater or lesser extent, have both of those things. But that is not the only answer. We also need You know, government means to steer things. Government is supposed to be acting in our interests, and our governments have not been acting in the interests of the majority of American people when it comes to agriculture and health, nutrition, environment for a long, long time.
When you look at people who are trying to make a change in the food system, the local foods movement has really gained a lot of steam over the last few years, but it's still so incredibly small. And it gets a lot of media coverage, in public radio in particular, a lot of media coverage about the local foods movement. But I often have to stop and remind myself, this is really small. Do you think, when you look at it, when you think about the changes that have been made, how significant do you think this is?
Well, it's small, but it's non-existent, and it's growing. So, again, you're right on both counts. It's not as big as it's made out to be, but it didn't exist. And local foods, while important, are not a panacea either. And I don't think that if we say, in a climate like that of the Northeast or that of the Midwest or even that of the middle of the country, you can't say we're going to do local food. But you can start to – the symbolism of local food is important. The existence of farmers' markets are important. The growth of the numbers of people thinking about these things is important. If I had to guess what was going to drive a sustainable, rational food system in the United States 20, 50, or 100 years from now, whenever that happens, I wouldn't say that it's going to be New York is supplied with food that comes from within 150 miles of the city, or that Iowa City is supplied with food that comes from 150 miles from the city. I would say that this is a country that naturally breaks down into five or six different regions, and each of those regions can be more or less self-supporting. And obviously, there's going to be interdependence among them, but that we can do better than growing nearly everything in a couple of states, and we can do better than eating grapes imported from Chile in the middle of the winter. That's not really the way that we should be eating.
I'm talking with best-selling food writer Mark Bittman. He was going to be appearing this evening in Iowa City. His plans have been canceled, or at least postponed, because of the blizzard. But we will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest is Mark Bittman. He is a journalist and food writer, best-selling author. He was going to speak this evening in Iowa City, but his trip has been delayed because of the blizzard. We had a chance to talk with him last week. And Mark, before the break, we were talking about the future of food and the state of our food system right now. Just before the break, you were talking about the local foods movement and how there are different regions in the U.S. where there's a possibility to have sustainable regional food systems. In many places, that would be tough, but in Iowa, it would be possible to produce the food we eat here. Right now, we produce 15% of the food that we actually eat in this state. And when I think about the magnitude of reversing that or changing that, and about the people who depend on food from Iowa, it's an extremely big task. Sometimes we make things simpler than it is. Do you think that we have a tendency in the media to oversimplify what's going on?
Well, some people do and some people don't, I guess. I try not to. It is a huge task ahead of us, which is why I've said before and I will continue to say it's poco a poco. It's one step at a time. And you can't say we're going to revolutionize agriculture in Iowa and have that be a meaningful statement. It isn't a meaningful statement. But you can say, 30 or 35% of the corn produced in state goes into making biofuels, and you can question whether that's a good policy. And you can say 40% or maybe another 35% of the corn that's produced in state, or the corn and soybeans produced in state, goes into producing meat. And you can question whether that's a policy you want to support. I mean, these things are the ethanol thing is a mandate. The growing of corn and soybeans for animals raised in CAFOs is not a mandate, but it is supported by government activity. We can question these things. We can wonder whether we need to be eating quite as much meat as we do. We can wonder whether we need to be producing quite as much meat as we do. And these are things that will change diet and agriculture, nutrition, our impact on the environment. They can all be altered, and it's not quite the same thing as saying we need to get rid of corn and soybeans in Iowa. That's a step that no one can really say with any credibility. But to say we ought to be questioning the ethanol mandate, that's a perfectly reasonable. That could start right now. I mean, it exists. Those questions exist.
You talk about the idea that maybe people should be eating less meat, maybe we should be producing less meat. You made a change in your diet a few years ago and wrote a couple of books about it. You call it the VB6, vegan until 6 p.m. And so just reducing the meats and animal products in your diet. For people who aren't familiar with your writing on that, what was it that prompted that change for you?
You know, this goes back to the discussion we had a few minutes ago about personal choice and personal change. I think what's clear is that if you were to invent a diet that was as damaging to health as you could be, it would look something like the diet that many Americans have. This is why we have, you know, healthcare crisis. This is why we have the so-called obesity epidemic. We eat way too many animal products, and even more than that, we eat way too much junk food, hyper-processed food. And I think I'm going to talk about VB6, but I'm also going to talk about it in a more reduced, more compressed, more compact fashion. So VB6 is a diet I invented for myself, which was successful, so I later published a book about it. And it is essentially a diet where one eats only foods from the plant kingdom until 6 o'clock at night, and unprocessed foods at that. So no pasta, white rice, no bread, but really salads, stir fries, legumes, whole grains, fruits, vegetables, nuts in more or less unlimited quantity, but really in as unprocessed form as possible. And then at 6 o'clock, you do whatever you want. You eat, you drink, you eat whatever you want, including meat, fish, even limited amounts of junky food. So that is that is really just a strategy, one among many strategies for getting more plants into your diet. And I think this is what I meant by saying this in a more compact form. I think that for almost every single person in this country, for everyone I know certainly, and for almost everyone else knows, there's a goal, and the goal is to eat more plants, basically. And I think if people just thought, I'm going to eat more plants, less processed food, fewer animal products this week than I did last week, and this month that I did last month, and this year than I did last year, and I'm going to keep doing that, that's a very simple statement towards moving to a better diet. It's not always easy. Simple doesn't mean easy. It's not always easy to do. It's not always easy to apply, but it is pretty easy to understand, and it is pretty simple to say and think about. And I think that rule pretty much applies to everybody.
Saying that, it sounds very reasonable.
Having said that, right? Yeah. I said it was simple, it wasn't right. Easy. There's a big difference.
But also, I mean, I know a lot of people in Iowa who are farmers who, when they hear somebody say that, they get scared. They feel defensive and they get scared. So in Iowa, it's a pretty political statement for a lot of people to say that. But a lot of research has gone into showing that health-wise, it's not a political statement.
You know, no one wants to threaten anybody else's living. Of course, that's true. But there are way fewer farmers now in Iowa than there were a generation or two ago. And that's a well-known fact. And the farmers that there are in Iowa right now are generally farming way more acres than they were. And they're doing it industrially. And this they may be making money, and I don't begrudge them that opportunity. But they are not doing the land. They are not doing animals that are produced in CAFOs. They are not doing humans who eat hormone and antibiotic-laden food any favors. So when you see that something is a problem, your first question really should be, how do we fix this problem, not how many jobs might this cost at the end of the day. I mean, the reactionary statement, the generally Republican cry that this is a job-killing bill or these are job-killing things to say, works, and it's very clever, but jobs are not the only consideration. We are supposedly a nation that looks for the greatest good for the greatest number, and sometimes individuals are negatively affected, or let's not use jargon, sometimes individuals are hurt when you make decisions that help the majority of people. You know, it's like saying we shouldn't be talking about banning intercontinental ballistic missiles because it'll put scientists out of work. Of course we should be talking about banning them.
With the personal change that you made in your diet, and I can imagine that was a little daunting for you given your line of work, to even think about being vegan two-thirds of the time, what kind of changes did that make for you personally?
Well, if you're talking about, you know, a whole host of things, and if you're talking about the benefits, my cholesterol went down, my blood sugar levels went down, my blood pressure went down, my weight, of course, went. I lost 15% of my body weight, which ironically is about the amount of weight that most of us could stand to lose. There are only positive personal results from this, but you know, on a level of offering myself a challenge and meeting it, it was kind of healthy also, which was fun. And then professionally, it's interesting because most of us, or at least I won't even speak for most of us, I tend to eat breakfast and lunch alone. So all of the social pressures to eat more and to eat a wider variety of things and to drink, of course, all of those social pressures, or almost none of those social pressures exist for me at breakfast and lunch. At dinner, they do. So sometimes people say, well, vegan before 6, isn't it healthier to have your bigger meals earlier in the day? Don't you want to eat lighter at night and so on? And I think that those things are probably true. But the point is that most of us are quite social at dinner. And there's a lot of social pressure to eat. Yeah, to eat with your friends and to eat the way your friends are eating. And this takes that into account. I like to go out to dinner. I like to eat with other people. I like to drink at night. And I wanted to think of a way to do this, let's say, plant-friendly diet that would allow me to be socially friendly in the evening.
In your cookbooks, Teaching People How to Cook Everything, and you focused in your most recent cookbook, How to Cook Everything Fast, but do you feel, I want to talk about really a couple of generations of people for whom cooking at home has not been second nature. And a lot of us, when we were growing up, didn't even really learn how to cook. Is there a huge knowledge gap for people who are now thinking, oh, I would like to cook at home more and I would like to eat healthier, as far as actually knowing what to do with food?
You know, it's not, I don't think it is. I'm assuming you and I are of different generations, but I mean, you sound like you're much younger than me. So I don't think it's so much a knowledge gap as an example gap. And I can explain that. I did not learn how to cook growing up. No one taught me anything. But my mother demonstrated that it was important to put a home-cooked meal on the table every night. And no doubt I learned some things like how to turn on the broiler and how to prepare salad and how to make rice and some other. No doubt I picked some of that stuff up from my mother. My mother was kind of an indifferent, obligated cook, as many women, and they were all women, were in the 50s. So when I decided to learn how to cook, which I did for a variety of reasons, I had at least some understanding of what kitchens looked like and what people's routines looked like and how to operate appliances and so on. I think that the couple of generations of people who grew up without parents who cook don't even have that. But they do have motivation because it's clear that cooking is a good and smart thing to do. And this is not entirely a self-serving statement, although it may sound like one. I learned how to cook from cookbooks mostly. And cookbooks can, the good thing about cookbooks is they work. They're instruction manuals and they can teach people how to cook. And I feel that I at least have gotten better at writing cookbooks over the 30 years or whatever it is that I've been doing it. And that How to Cook Everything Fast, which is my latest, is really an effective, I think it's an effective teaching tool. I was ambitious about it and the results have been good and people seem to like it. So that's great. There has to be obviously some will and some discipline and some determination on the part of someone to learn how to cook, but it can be done. It's not that hard. We all learn how to drive, and it's not that different on the level of difficulty.
Your cookbooks tend to have a lot more information than just recipes. Is it important to have sort of a greater understanding of how food works to be a good cook?
No, I think fast, How to Cook Everything Fast, is designed so you can walk into the kitchen with a recipe and assuming you have the ingredients, you're going to cook something successfully. I think there is a lot to know about operating in the kitchen that is more than just how to apply heat to food. And some of that is, I include this stuff because people ask it all the time. What should I buy for equipment? What should I have in my pantry? How should I organize my kitchen? Those are all questions. You can figure that stuff out by yourself. It'll take you years and years, or you can sit down and read for 15 minutes and get some information about how to do it. And I think it's important to include that information, so I do.
When I think about recent changes in how people cook and what kinds of foods have become very desirable for, quote, foodies, there in some ways there's almost this, and I know it's always been done, but now I see it on Instagram and on the internet, you know, this fetish about, you know, certain kinds of food and the amount of work that goes into creating the perfect dish or the perfect dish at a restaurant. Do you think that kind of culture, are taking pictures of all of these dishes and sharing them, do you think that scares some people out of the kitchen?
I think that perfect is the enemy of good, not to be too corny. I think that cooking is about compromise. You're never going to create a perfect dish. You're never going to have the perfect ingredients. You're never going to have as many skills as you think you ought to. You're never going to have as much time as you would like to have. And it's important to recognize that. And putting good food on the table for yourself or your friends or your family or all three is way more important than making a perfect dish. Making a perfect dish is a fun thing to do, but we don't seek perfection in much of our lives. We try to get stuff done. And cooking, it's important to get cooking done. It's not that important to make cooking be perfect.
In your most recent book, How to Cook Everything Fast, you're still talking about cooking wholesome food and cooking it at home. Is there a sort of a secret to cutting down on the amount of time you spend making these dishes? Obviously, you're not looking for something that is absolutely perfect, ready for a restaurant plate. But what's the secret?
There's no secrets. There's a body of knowledge. And as I said, you can take a recipe in fast and go through it without thinking about it, and you will have cooked a fast recipe. But it's easier if you have a well-organized kitchen. It's easier if you have the right ingredients around in the first place. It's easier if once every week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks you spend some time preparing some long-keeping things that you can stash in the fridge or freezer. All of those things make sense. And all of that is pretty much common knowledge. What's a little bit different about fast is that there are some techniques that are streamlined. There are some recipes that are cooked in ways that I certainly hadn't thought of cooking them before. There are some, as I say, there are just some quick techniques. It's not so much secrets. It's that I've been doing this for a long time, and I got together with a number of colleagues, including, you know, editors and designers, not just cooks, and said, how can we make it so that recipes read more quickly, people can go through them more quickly, they're better organized? Is there a better way to do this? And I think that the answer to that is yes. I think this is representative of that. It doesn't so much represent the revelation of secrets as it does represent 4 years of steady and hard work by a number of people who worked with me.
Mark Bittman is a journalist, a food writer, a best-selling author. His most recent book is How to Cook Everything Fast. He was going to be speaking this evening in Iowa City as part of the Food for Thought themed semester at the University of Iowa. Unfortunately, weather has intervened. The University of Iowa Lecture Series is working on rescheduling his appearance. We did have an opportunity to talk with him last week, and we'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Also coming up this hour, I'll talk with two Iowa State University students who are also concerned about the future of food and looking for ways to solve the problems of world hunger. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest is Mark Bittman, journalist, food writer, best-selling author. He was going to be speaking this evening in Iowa City. Unfortunately, because of the weather, that trip has been canceled. The University of Iowa Lecture Committee is working on rescheduling with him for another date. We did speak with him last week, and just before the break, we were talking about his most recent book, How to Cook Everything Fast. And Mark, one of the things that makes food preparation faster, of course, is practice and also experience, having that kind of knowledge that allows you to work with confidence in the kitchen. Was that a concern for you? If someone thinks, I want to learn to cook and I want to learn to cook everything fast, don't you have to learn how to cook before you can do things fast?
No. This book is totally basic. And as I said, the idea is that you can, if you have the ingredients, you can pick up one of these recipes and a complete novice can work his or her way through it. And I've seen it and I've heard about it. I've talked to people about it. This stuff works. I think the book was written in response to two things that I hear all the time. One is, I don't have the time for cooking. Well, that's why we call it How to Cook Everything Fast, because cooking takes some time, so you need to make a commitment. But these are recipes that can be done quickly. No one is ever going to write a book called How to Cook Everything in 0 minutes. So this is a move towards making things happen more quickly. The other thing that people say is that they're scared. They're afraid to cook. And again, I think that and I try to address that. The recipes are simple. I think they're easy to follow and so on. But I think it's important to remember that we were all scared when we learned how to drive also. But we had a reason to learn how to drive, and we wanted to learn how to drive. And we do have reasons to learn how to cook. We just need to want to learn how to cook. We need to prioritize it because it is doable. It's something that literally billions of people have and do around the world, and you don't need to be smart. You don't need to be skilled. It certainly helps if you know how to read, although that's not even essential. It's not that hard to do. It is a little bit scary for many people because they don't have the experience and they haven't seen others do it. And as you say, they sometimes see others do it perfectly, and they think, oh, I need to do this perfectly too. But we don't drive our cars perfectly. We don't play tennis perfectly. There's almost nothing in our lives that we do perfectly. We shouldn't expect to cook perfectly either.
I love your description of your mother as an obligated cook. And I think that with our food culture today, there may be an idea that if you're going to cook, you should enjoy cooking. I'm not somebody who enjoys cooking. Do you have any tips for people to find an enjoyment in it, or is that necessary?
Well, the obvious and not entirely serious quip, but the one that gets brought up by many people all the time, is that cooking gives you an excuse to start drinking earlier. So obviously it's difficult to suggest that, and it's not entirely a joke, but that is a thing that's commonly said and commonly practiced. So there is that. There's also the notion that cooking can be relaxing. Cooking gives you a sense of fulfillment. Cooking allows you to produce something that not only can be attractive, but can be enjoyed, and not only by yourself, but by others. It can give you a sense of nurturing, because that's indeed exactly what you're doing. It can give you a sense of doing better, because cooking is almost always better than any alternative. And none of those things may make it so that you call me next year and say, well, now I like it. You may still not like it, but all of those things can be fulfilling, you know, and this gets, Phil, just as before we were talking about things that were political, not about cooking, this gets into philosophy or psychology rather than cooking. What's important? Having fun? Yeah, well, having fun is important, but other values, other fulfilling values are important also. And I think that the ones that I just mentioned are good enough reason to spend a little time in the kitchen, even though it's, you know, may not be as much fun as watching a movie.
I want to get back to some of the more political issues that we were talking about earlier. There have been some recent developments that are kind of interesting. Now, one is in California with the changes, rule changes to how eggs can be produced in California that should allow laying chickens to have significantly more space to live in more humane conditions. When you see something like that, does that give you a hope for the future of food production?
It gives me hope for the future of food production in California. But seriously, the price of eggs has gone up. So the question is this a good or a bad thing? And I would argue that it's a good thing, because to have eggs that cost 25 cents or 20 cents, which is what they cost if they're between $2 and $3 a dozen, it's kind of when you think about it, it's kind of insulting that you could create such a perfect and beautiful food for so little money. And you could say, well, this is the triumph of American agriculture, but it's not the triumph of American agriculture. It's the outsourcing of the real costs of producing that egg. And to the extent that we integrate the real costs of producing eggs into eggs, they're going to get more expensive. And this is not a bad thing. Americans spend less than 10% of our income on food, and that's the lowest rate of expenditures on food of any country in the world, barring maybe a couple of minor places no one's ever heard of. It's the lowest amount people spend anywhere in the world. We need to spend more on food so that we can have better food, and we need to spend more on food so that we can have lower healthcare costs and do less environmental damage. Those things all go together. So this is not even that strong a measure, the California egg rule. It's a good rule, but it's not that strong a measure. But it's an indication that food will get more expensive as it gets better. And there's one other interesting thing that's happening here, which is that there was a fear that people were going to be driven out of the egg production business by this California rule because they couldn't meet the standards that it sets. And in fact, there's evidence that more people are getting into the business, the egg production business, because it's more profitable, because eggs are more expensive, and making the space adjustment turns out to be not that difficult and not that expensive. So I'm hopeful because it shows that we can pass good regulations, good legislation that says, okay, we want to protect animals, we want to protect the environment, we want to protect our health, we want to protect workers, and so on down the line, and that it can be demonstrated that food can still be profitable to grow and produce food. And, you know, now I have to say, this is inevitably raises the issue of what about people who can't afford more expensive food? Of course, it should raise that issue. And it goes back to where we started at the top of the show, which is not all of these issues are really food issues. Some of them are social justice issues. And if people can't afford to buy good food, that's not the good food's fault. That's a problem with society.
You've also written quite a bit about the fact that if the minimum wage was increased, or if fast food restaurants such as McDonald's were required to pay a living wage, that you feel that fast food would collapse.
Yeah, now there's evidence that I was wrong about that, because there's been some economic modeling done that says, yeah, you can pay your workers $15 an hour. You can give your workers health insurance. And there are benefits to doing those things. Your workers are happier. There's less turnover. There's less resentment. They're working fewer second jobs so that they have more energy when they're at their place of employment, and so on down the line. So again, maybe fast food is becoming more expensive anyway, because people are choosing to buy higher quality, people who can afford to are choosing to buy higher quality fast food. This is why Chipotle and Shake Shack and so on are becoming more profitable. McDonald's is becoming less profitable. But when you look at the more expensive fast food places, you're also seeing places where labor, generally speaking, is treated better. So there is still a model for making money in fast food. It just needs to be better food, and it needs to treat people better.
Well, you mentioned Chipotle, and Chipotle recently made the decision to stop selling pork that is not produced up to their standards. And in the past, they, when beef production had not been up to their standards, they had sold it, but they had, you know, put up a sign and said, this is not beef that was produced up to our standards. This time, they just decided to stop selling pork in many of their restaurants. What do you think that indicates?
It was an interesting thing on Chipotle. It'll be interesting to see where they go, because supply breeds demand and demand breeds supply, and they follow each other. And Chipotle is changed. Chipotle and others, Panera as well, but also many, many institutions around the country now are looking for antibiotic-free meat. They're looking for sustainable products. They're looking for local products. And that demand is changing the supply chain and will continue to do so. So, but, you know, it's an interesting time. I think both you and I in the course of this conversation have sounded like we'd like to see change, or we recognize that many people expect to see change very quickly. But I think the real message is 10 years ago, you and I are not having this conversation, even 5 years ago. We are having it now. There's meaningful things to be said. There's meaningful change happening and in the air. It just happens to be very slow. We're very impatient people. But this food stuff is changing, and it's moving in the right direction, I think.
Mark Bittman, thank you so much.
It was great to be here. Thanks for the conversation.
Mark Bittman is a food writer and best-selling author. His most recent book is How to Cook Everything Fast. He was going to be giving a lecture in Iowa City this evening about the future of food, but that event has been postponed because of the weather. And a lot of people are thinking about the future of food in the United States and all over the world, and it's impossible to think about the future of food without thinking about the very big problem of food security, hunger. Two Iowa State University students are two of 10 students around the country participating in the Land O'Lakes Global Food Challenge Emerging Leaders for Food Security Fellowship. Each student is focusing on a different challenge. Olivia Reichs is a junior in supply chain management and business economics. Hello, Olivia.
Hello.
Trey Forsyth is a sophomore in agricultural business and agriculture and society. Hello, Trey.
Good morning.
Thank you both for being here today. And Olivia, I know that you're focusing your research on reducing food waste. What's the problem that you've identified?
Well, so far through my research, a lot of people don't understand that one-third of the world's food is being wasted globally, even in undeveloped countries. The difference between them and the United States is it's happening in the production and handling stages. So my plan is working with the supply chain and the transportation and warehousing to improve the food waste that's currently happening.
Can you give me an idea of some of the possible solutions that you might try to implement?
Right. So, yeah, I'm working with like the Enterprise Acceleration Program. So giving individuals the opportunity to specialize in just transporting or warehousing, like in vacuum packing, or even having the roads and the infrastructure in order to move it using the technology we have over here.
All right. And can you give me, just for people who may have a hard time actually understanding the real world impact of this, can you give me an example of the kind of food waste that you want to tackle?
Well, even with pests and insects, when they harvest their crops and they don't have high demand to sell it, they're often forced to sell it at a lower rate, which doesn't give them enough income to get throughout the year, or the pests destroy it and their families don't have enough to make it through the winter. So I really want to help be able to store the food longer, which will enable them to sell it later when the demand is higher, and it'll just improve their overall economy.
All right. And Trey, what's the problem that you're focusing on?
Olivia and I actually kind of, and through separate routes, kind of came across the same problem and have different ways of going about it that kind of play hand in hand. My problem, again, focuses on the dangerous infrastructure and poor transportation modes that these developing countries have. You know, they can't travel 50 to 100 miles to transport their crops to where they need to go. Their roads aren't safe. You know, a lot of times they have to leave crops on the side of the road or return home because, you know, the journey's just not worth it. So what I'm doing, as I'm looking at creating cooperatives for with food processing equipment. So farmers can, in closer villages, closer communities, take their crops to get processed in a mechanical way through extrusion is what the technology is called. They can take their raw products that they harvest. They can turn them into either livestock feed or you know, different human food products, and then they can either return those back to their home to feed themselves and their neighbors, or they can take it to market.
So you're looking at bringing the processing closer to the producers.
Yeah, making the processing more local instead of having, you know, big business that they have to travel thousands of miles to get to.
You will both be traveling to Africa this summer as part of the fellowship, spending 2 weeks in Africa, and then you'll spend another week in Washington, D.C., studying policy when you get back. In August, you'll be presenting your projects at the Global Food Challenge Summit. Olivia, when you present your project, is there an opportunity that it will actually be implemented?
Yes, I think that's one of the reasons Land O'Lakes originally started this. Their International Development Division is already doing so much over in Africa, and they're just looking for more and continued new ideas to help move along what they already got going.
And Trey, when you're thinking about presenting this project and possible actual implementation, are you creating a business plan so that we actually can put real figures on all of these ideas?
Yeah, absolutely. The first assignment Land O'Lakes gave us was I'm investigating the feasibility of our idea. You know, is this something that could actually become a part of Land O'Lakes International Development or a part of Land O'Lakes business, you know? Whether that's economic figures or figuring out production statistics or whatever it is, it's figuring out how feasible this is and presenting it to the people at Land O'Lakes who could make a project like this happen.
We're almost out of time, but I would love for each of you to tell me one thing in your research that has really surprised you so far. Olivia?
So far for me, it's just that there is so many solutions that are working over there. It's just we need to learn to expand those solutions across the entire continent. And not stop with just a few communities.
All right, Trey?
I would say I've been surprised at how much things like this are going to be tackled by a community-to-community basis. You know, you're not going to solve world hunger by doing something for an entire continent. You have to take it community by community, town by town, and slowly expand it to make it work.
Trey Forsythe, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Olivia Reichs, thank you.
Thank you.
Olivia Reichs and Trey Forsythe of Iowa State University. They've been selected to participate in the Land O'Lakes Global Food Challenge Emerging Leaders for Food Security Fellowship. Talk of Iowa is produced by Emily Woodbury, Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can get in touch with us anytime. Send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'd love to hear your reaction to things you've heard on the show. We'd love to hear your suggestions for things you would like to hear on the show in the future. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.